Before we start, I want to tell you about another podcast I'm enjoying, Face Off, United States versus China. It's about how the two nations, once friends, are now foes, and why things are so complicated now. The host, Jane Perlez, was Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. On Face Off, she talks with diplomats, spies, cultural superstars like Yo-Yo Ma, and more. You can listen to Face Off, the US versus China, wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks very much for joining me again.
I'm James Curran. I'm Professor of Modern History here at Sydney University and also the International Editor at the Australian Financial Review, where I write regularly about Australia in world affairs.
Today, I'm looking at how Australia redefined its relations with the United States in the 1970s and 1980s, looking at how Prime Minister Gough Whitlam and later Prime Ministers brought a new maturity to the relationship with Washington. Bear in mind the context here. Bear in mind that Harold Holt, as Prime Minister, had stood beside President Lyndon Johnson in Washington in 1966 and said that Australia was
all the way with LBJ
in Vietnam. Bear in mind, before that, that when Australia had looked to Washington, to the Kennedy administration for assistance in a possible war with Indonesia over the confrontation episode, the External Affairs Minister at the time, Sir Garfield Barwick, had to drag his backside along the ground outside the Oval Office when Kennedy said that the United States would only give limited, mainly logistical support to Australia in the event of such a conflict. And remember the point from the previous episode that all the great changes in American policy in Vietnam, whether it be a cessation of the bombing, the withdrawal of troops, or the attempts to reach a negotiation and a settlement with the North Vietnamese, all of these decisions were taken without prior consultation with the Australians. So the question coming into the early 1970s, especially after Australia had been blindsided by Nixon's opening to communist China, with Australian Prime Minister Billy McMahon absolutely horrified that Australia had not been given advance warning, the question was, what was the alliance supposed to mean? With that in mind, let's look at this episode of a new maturity in Australia's relations with the United States. America's defeat in the Vietnam War, followed by the enunciation of President Nixon's so-called Guam Doctrine, had shaken to its roots Australia's faith in the alliance. Though Australia had been a loyal ally in the war, the United States had not consulted it about its new policies towards East Asia, its withdrawal from Vietnam, and its decision not again to be involved in wars on the mainland of Asia, or its change of policy towards communist China. Some of the conservative leaders who had stood firm in their support for the United States in Vietnam felt betrayed. Malcolm Fraser, who was defense minister in the latter part of the Vietnam War, felt that Australia was
likely to be more alone than ever before.
His Prime Minister, John Gorton, predicted following these events that America was
going to be less and less interested in this part of the world.
For the Whitlam Labor government, the end of the Vietnam War and the thaw in East-West relations was not so much a cause for fear as opportunity, and to revise in a more constructive way Australia's relations with the United States. Neither the Labor Party nor Gough Whitlam wanted to do away with the American alliance. Whitlam asserted that ANZUS was of enduring importance, that it was a security guarantee against the ultimate peril. Australia looked to America as a possible great power protector in the Pacific, as a source of capital investment and technological resources, and even to some degree as a political and cultural model. Whitlam himself often spoke of his admiration for Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. In the new international and regional context, however, Whitlam was adamant that membership of the alliance did not constitute a foreign policy. Coming out of a period in which a Liberal Prime Minister had promised to go all the way with LBJ, Whitlam asserted that Australia should play a more active and self-respecting role in the world. It would act independently both inside and outside the alliance in pursuing its national interest. Within days of being appointed, Prime Minister Whitlam put his new policy into effect. Without consulting the Americans, he instructed the Australian delegate on the UN Political Committee to vote for a resolution favouring the neutrality of the Indian Ocean. He proceeded to establish full diplomatic relations immediately with the People's Republic of China and East Germany, and he ordered the withdrawal of Australia's last 128 military advisers from Saigon and halted all military aid to South Vietnam. These were all actions which either were opposed by the United States or were greatly embarrassing to Washington. During the next 3 years, in partnership with the New Zealand Labor government, and remember that these two Labor governments in early 1973 reaffirmed the principles of the 1944 ANZAC Agreement. Whitlam, during this period, gave vivid, sometimes controversial expression to his view of how Australia should understand the ANZUS Treaty and the alliance. It can be seen most clearly in his government's attitude to the continuing Vietnam War, its attempts to revise the conditions governing US intelligence facilities on Australian soil, and to a lesser extent, its initiatives in trying to create so-called zones of peace in Southeast Asia, South Pacific and the Indian Ocean, that is, in the region surrounding Australian territory. So let's look at Vietnam. Whitlam, in his election campaign, had denounced Australian and American policy in Vietnam as disastrous. Australian and US policy had been a failure, he said. It had been the war of the great lie. Echoing his former leader, Arthur Corwell, he urged that
the part of a good friend and ally was to assist the American people in the liquidation of the war they had come to hate.
Labor felt justified in its formerly unpopular opposition to the war. Australia would help the Americans to come to terms with the humiliation of their defeat. So when President Richard Nixon, shortly after the Labor government came to power, began a massive bombing of North Vietnam's major centres of population, Hanoi and Haiphong, some senior Labor ministers openly condemned it. One minister called the bombing
the most brutal, indiscriminate slaughter of men, women and children.
And another accused the Americans of mass murder, of acting with the mentality of thuggery. Maritime unions placed a complete ban on all American shipping in Australian ports. Washington was horrified. Australia had moved from being America's most loyal ally to being its chief critic. No government representative from any other country had spoken in such harsh terms of the American bombing, with the exception perhaps of Swedish Prime Minister Olaf Palme, or allowed unions to impose bans on American shipping and trade. When, however, the United States complained to the Australian government, Whitlam replied in a letter to President Nixon that while he had not publicly criticised the American government, he would not apologise for his minister's words, and if America repeated the bombing, he would himself be compelled to speak out, and he might take the matter to the United Nations. In conclusion, he set out the new general principle with which Australia would approach the alliance. While assuring the president that differences over Vietnam did
not detract from our positive approach towards future cooperation between the two nations,
he said that
it cannot be taken for granted that Australia will necessarily agree with the US, either privately or publicly, on all matters of public concern.
This was strong language for a small power to use in addressing a superpower which it hoped would act as a shield against possible regional enemies. Though with the signing of the Geneva Peace Accords in January 1973, America ceased to be involved in the war, and with this, the bombing question disappeared, the controversy stirred up by this incident continued to trouble Australian-American relations. President Nixon was so irate at the Australian minister's actions and Whitlam's defiant letter that at first he refused to receive the Australian Prime Minister at the White House during the latter's visit to North America later that year. Under great pressure, though, from the State Department and his National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, Nixon finally relented. Not to do so, considering that Nixon had just feted Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev, the secretary of the Soviet Union's Communist Party, would, as one diplomat put it, have been
a foolish display of public petulance towards a friend and ally.
When Whitlam visited Washington in July 1973, he spoke with a new voice. He did not grovel or plaintively seek assurances that the ANZUS guarantees could be relied on, that America would come to Australia's aid in time of crisis. At a press conference in the capital of the world, he said, speaking for Australia, that
we are not a satellite of any country. We are a friend and partner of the United States, particularly in the Pacific, but with an independent interest of our own.
Whitlam might speak in defiant tones, but it was brought home sharply to him how little America knew and probably cared about Australia when an American national TV presenter introduced the Australian Prime Minister to viewers as Mr. E. Go Whitlam. On the question of America's bases in Australia, its intelligence facilities. Labor's most constant criticism of America's intelligence facilities at Narunga, Pine Gap, and Northwest Cape was that they derogated from Australian sovereignty. This was especially the case for the Northwest Cape facility, through which the Americans, without any reference to Australia, could pass instructions to their Polaris missile-armed submarines in the Indian Ocean. Whitlam had called the Northwest Cape facility for this reason
thoroughly obnoxious.
In November 1973, when it seemed that Russia might intervene in the Arab-Israeli war, which had just broken out, America had put all its facilities around the globe on full alert. Alarmed by the possible consequences, the Australian Minister of Defence was sent to Washington to seek joint control over the use of the base, that is, an effective veto over its use. The Americans would not, however, make any substantive concessions to Defence Minister Lance Barnard. The most they would allow was that the Australian flag should fly alongside the American one at the base, and that an Australian might be named Deputy Commander. But the Deputy Commander was never to command. No Australian was to have access to the communications building on the base. Whitlam had to make do with this, but he threatened not to renew the agreement when the terms of the existing treaty expired. And when he did that, all hell broke loose in Washington, and you can follow that story in detail in my 2015 book called Unholy Fury, Nixon and Whitlam at War. Let's look at Whitlam's approach to zones of peace and nuclear-free zones. It was also part of the Whitlam government's objective to keep the superpowers and their conflicts from troubling Australia's region to the west, that is the Indian Ocean, to the north, that is Southeast Asia, and to the east, the South Pacific. To this end, it proposed the establishment of peace zones and nuclear-free zones for its immediate neighbourhood. It also sought a non-aggression pact to cover Southeast Asia. Now, none of these proposals had American support. Nearly all of them were opposed by Washington. So the initiatives fell on barren soil. In practice, the Australians found it too difficult to obtain the consent of all the parties. Great power hostility and intra-regional antagonism negated all of Australia's efforts. But once again, Australia had acted independently of the Americans. It no longer sought to maintain peace in the region through cooperation in forward defence with its great and powerful Western friends. And Whitlam, for the first time since the establishment of the alliance with the United States, had forced America to take Australia seriously. It could no longer be taken for granted. Thus, for the first time, the United States sent a senior professional diplomat, Marshall Green, to Canberra. Green was an Asian troubleshooter. Some said that he was Washington's hatchet man. And indeed, when Whitlam was dismissed from office by the Governor-General in November 1975, some suggested that Green and or the CIA had a hand in it. But there is no evidence still, and believe me, I have looked high, low and wide for this evidence. There is no evidence yet, or good reason to think that the CIA contributed to the constitutional crisis. However, I would say there is some sort of smoke and scutch fires still smouldering around this episode. Still documents where Americans are talking about spooky fiddling in Australia and not wanting to get caught. At the end of the Whitlam government's term in office, the Americans had come to recognise, even if reluctantly and resentfully, that since what they offered Australia was qualified and limited, Australia's right to act for itself in the world had to be respected. Marshall Green, for example, gave a speech to the Australian-American Association in New York at the end of 1975. He said on that occasion that Australian-American relations were undergoing what he called
a maturation process.
Though the ties were not as close as they had been in earlier years, nevertheless the relationship, he said, was
in some ways healthier than it was before.
And Australia was determined
to do its own thing.
And he described the sycophantic slogans of the Vietnam era as a
downright embarrassment.
So much for all the way. The change that had taken place had bipartisan support. Green said that now, perhaps gritting his teeth,
all parties, Labour, Liberal and Country Party, are in favour of a nationalistic policy for Australia. We understand it and agree with it.
Australia's new understanding of the ANZUS relationship was carried over into defence planning. In October 1975, the Defence Committee, composed of the heads or senior officials of the Prime Minister's Defence, Foreign Affairs and Treasury Departments, plus the heads of the armed services, approved a new strategic basis for defence policy which stated that Australia's alliance with the United States did
not mean that in all circumstances Australia must support the US or can be expected to be supported by it. nor does it mean that there could not be circumstances modifying or supplementing the US association in which Australia could act in cooperation with the USSR or China or Japan or India and other powers which had common interests at the time with Australia.
It was an expanded version of the 1959 Defence Committee's recommendations to Cabinet. But at this time, the analysis was set within a strategic context that did not envisage Australia for the foreseeable future, that is, over the next 10 to 15 years, having to face a direct threat to its security. Australia's defence authorities did not, as had earlier been predicted, see Australia being threatened as a result of the communist victory in Vietnam. The dominoes had not fallen in Southeast Asia. The Vietnamese communists were nationalists before they were communists. Indeed, by 1978, the Vietnamese communists were at war over border disputes with communist China. What the Australians had learned from the experience was that it was foolish to place complete trust in the American alliance for their defence. They had learned that the American commitment to the alliance, that Australia and the United States had in some important respects different interests. They had learned that they could not even rely on the United States to consult them about regional matters that affected their vital interests. They had been warned that in case of difficulties or conflict with its neighbours, it could not rely on American aid. They therefore had to return to the first premise of a nation state, and so Australia prepared to provide for its own continental defence and to act independently within and without the alliance to safeguard Australia's interests. Malcolm Fraser, in his first major foreign policy speech after becoming Prime Minister, confirmed the new orthodoxy. As he put it,
"The interests of the US and the interests of Australia were not necessarily identical. In our relations with great powers, our first responsibility is to independently assess our own interest. The US will unquestionably do the same."
At the end of the Asian Cold War, then, Australia had found that it could not blindly look to Western great powers to protect it in an Asia in which Asians sensitive to Western imperialism governed themselves. Britain had retreated into Europe. America had defined the limits of its responsibility. For Australia, the American alliance was, however, still very important. It had bipartisan political support as well as overwhelming public support. Australia and America shared an English-speaking cultural heritage and many common political and social values. Moreover, even if it was not a cast-iron guarantee, its very existence had the advantage of making any power which might wish to cause trouble for Australia weigh carefully its actions. The Hawke government in the 1980s continued the balanced policy which had begun with Whitlam and Fraser. Bill Hayden, as Foreign Minister, said that
"Australia was independent as well as aligned."
And he criticised the American government's intervention in Central America, especially its attempt to undermine the Sandinista government in Nicaragua and its invasion of Grenada. The Labor government also embarrassed the Reagan administration by pursuing independent peace and disarmament policies in the United Nations. Furthermore, it refused also to allow the Americans to test the new generation MX missile in Australia, since it thought these new weapons would escalate the arms race with the Soviet Union. On the other hand, the Hawke government supported the Americans on other more fundamental issues. It accepted the American intelligence facilities as a contribution to superpower nuclear deterrence and as a contribution to the monitoring of the Soviet-American anti-ballistic missile and SALT treaties. When in 1984, following the New Zealand Labor government's refusal to allow American nuclear-powered or armed vessels to visit its ports, the United States suspended New Zealand from ANZUS. That is, it refused to share intelligence with Wellington and to take part in joint military exercises. Australia found itself in a quandary. The incident was irritating. The Hawke government disagreed with the New Zealanders and was troubled by the damage that was done to ANZUS. Nevertheless, it did not agree with the American response and continued to cooperate as closely with New Zealand as the relationship with Washington would allow. Bob Hawke, visiting the United States in the mid-1980s at the height of the Soviet-American dispute over the stationing of American Pershing missiles in Western Europe, declared,
"Australia was aligned, meaning on the side of the US. Australia would not be neutral in thought or deed."
Summing up then, we can say that as a result of the harsh experience with great and powerful friends in the 1960s, Australian political leaders and their policy advisers had been forced to realise that a foreign and defence policy predicated on the belief that Britain and America could be depended on to consider its interests and to protect the nation had failed them. Thus, in reaction, they looked to forging new ties with their East Asian neighbours. As a result of Britain entering the European Economic Community, Australia needed new markets for its commodity exports. Even more, following the American government's adoption of the Guam Doctrine, Australia perceived that it had direct security interests in becoming involved in the region. Australia did not see the need to choose between America and Asia, but it recognised that the United States, because of its preoccupation with the global superpower tensions, had different priorities from Australia. Australia, therefore, in defining itself anew in the region, had to learn to connect itself to this new Asia, an Asia in charge of its own destiny. And in finding this new, much more independent path, successive Australian governments adopted a policy of what came to be called comprehensive engagement with Asia. And it's that topic that I will take up in my next episode. Thank you.
I would also like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples for over 60,000 years who lived on, loved and dreamt about the lands on which I am speaking today. And I pay my respects to their present and future successors who continue to embody their affection for Australia and their enthusiasm for its well-being. This series is produced by Peter Adams for the School of Humanities at the University of Sydney.